Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Linden. My guest today is Bob Everly. Bob's been on many times before. He teaches philosophy at the Diablo Valley College, California. His books include Democracy Now! And Enemy of Deception. Bob, there's always another deception going on now. There is so many. I don't know if you have any on your mind to discuss, but I hope during the hour we'll get into a little bit more about what's going on in Egypt. I wrote two articles after the huge blood in the streets on Wednesday. I put out an article this morning I call Police State Egypt. I've got another one tomorrow going out called Bloody Friday. And the bloodletting continues. You can't keep up with this stuff, Bob.
You can't keep up with the news events, and you can't keep up with the lies that Obama tells about that and the other things that we'll end up talking about today, I'm sure. And as we go through this, one of the things that struck me just a couple of minutes ago when I was looking at the issues that we might be talking about, all of the issues seem to point to two particular facts, and they're really facts now. They're not something that you can prognosticate about. We've got a deepening domestic police state at home and an international criminal empire abroad that's deepening there as well. So it's here. It's a fact on each case. And all we can do is look to end it and find ways to bring it to an end and think about the future. So I think that all the things that we talk about come under that general umbrella that the notion of absolute power corrupts absolutely. We're seeing it right now in what you're saying. If you go to Egypt, I'm sorry, go ahead, Steve.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I would just echo what you just said. There is absolutely no question that America is a police state. I've written about it chapter and verse. I've done it for at least the last half dozen years. I haven't done it in rhetoric and ranting or any of that. I just cite the laws that are on the books, how they subvert international law, how they subvert constitutional law, and U.S. statute laws right across the board, one after another, and in most cases, not 100% of the time, but in most cases, the Congress that, of course, passes these laws and the courts up to the Supreme Court signs off on them. If that isn't a classic definition of a police state, I don't know what is.
Well, that goes right into the NSA stuff where even the votes now that are being taken in the Senate Intelligence Committee are being kept from Americans, and people like Dianne Feinstein, unfortunately my senator, keeps coming out saying, well, what we're doing there is classified. So what's going on? You are ruling us by classified votes so that we don't even know what you're doing? I mean, that's part of where we've gone in all of this, and we can talk more about that. What they're really trying to conceal right now, it seems to me, is what's going on with Syria, the Syrian fighters. The Senate Committee on Intelligence just, was it last week or maybe 2 weeks ago now, passed Obama's plan to funnel arms to the Syrian rebels. But they kept saying, all the senators that were on that committee said, well, our votes are classified, we can't tell you what we're going to do. We're ruling in your name, and we're telling you exactly what the Bush team did when we went into Iraq. It's classified, but trust us, we've got all the information we need to say this needs to be done. Just like they said, we've got all the information that would be involved in justifying an invasion of Iraq. It's the same thing repeating itself. So lies, conceit, cover, rule in secret, all that kind of stuff. And that's part of what you get with the mass protests in Egypt. This is going to be really interesting in kind of a dark way to see what happens in Egypt, because now the protests are defying the curfews that the military has put on the Egyptian people, and they're protesting anyway in large numbers, and they're being killed in large numbers, which puts the U.S. in a really difficult scenario, particularly when you look at how the protests are widening, not just in Egypt, but internationally. I mean, they're really mobilizing forces not just with the Muslim Brotherhood, but also with more liberal-oriented young people who have been protesting since 2011, the spring of 2011. And now the news this morning was that there are six other nations that are having large protests with thousands of protesters in solidarity with the Egyptian protesters. So the Palestinian territories, Turkey, Yemen, Pakistan, Malaysia, I think I got them all. Oh, Indonesia.
Indonesia, yeah.
And there are thousands of people that are now protesting in solidarity with the Egyptian protests against the United States. That puts Obama in a very tight corner because he refuses to say anything other than Well, we condemn the killings, but we're going to keep funneling billions of dollars of aid to the Egyptian military. Difficult situation to be in, but that's exactly what we're seeing.
Yeah, we're seeing it, Bob, and Obama has been very blunt. I published a White House statement on July 3rd after the coup, and it absolutely was a coup, a classic coup that ousted a democratically elected president. It wasn't the prettiest election in the world, but it certainly could have been a lot worse, and it was the only thing in Egypt's, at least modern history, any Egyptian history, where there literally was even a modicum of a democratic election, and the guy who took office was the guy who the people wanted. So it basically came out that way. Well, that's all swept by the boards. It's all erased, all eliminated, because the generals run Egypt. They have for decades. It's a long-standing situation in Egypt. I had an interview on Press TV, Bob, and I had a second Press TV interview on this as well. The Egyptian military has run the country for a very, very long time. After the coup, Egypt, I believe, has something like 25 governorates. I guess that's the equivalent of a U.S. state. 19 generals were appointed by the Egyptian junta to be the governors of these provinces, let's call them. Another two were longtime Mubarak loyalists. I don't know who the others were, but basically, you know, the right people supporting the tyrannical regime is put in power to keep things going the way they wanted it going. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood has been around for something like 85 years. It's gone through a lot of turmoil over that time. And on the one hand, I don't understand it because it's very pro-business. I've written about it several times. Very pro-business. The Muslim Brotherhood would get along very well with Wall Street and the Bank of England European Central Bank and the Bank of Bankers in Basel and all the others, but yet they've been targeted on and off for 85 years. Through most of that period, they were banned. Well, finally, they get into office, and they're thrown out, and there's a blurb in my article this morning. I picked it up and added it after I wrote the article that apparently the junta, through the spokespeople of the interim appointed government officials, Bob, say they're seriously looking into the legal justification for banning the Muslim Brotherhood.
For banning the Muslim Brotherhood?
For banning them altogether. I don't know how you come up with a legal justification, but you can bet your life they're going to do it.
All they have to do is ask the Washington lawyers. They've got all kinds of ways to cover that type of stuff going on.
Oh, yeah. We remember John Yoo in the Bush administration, how he justified torture. They can justify anything they want.
Yeah, that was my first thought. Go back to you and the others from the Bush people. They know how to cover that stuff up really well.
They sure can do it very, very easily. You can always manipulate the law, avoid it, or twist it any way you want to do to come up with any decision you want. And if the Muslim Brotherhood was banned for most of its 85 years, it looks for certain as though it's going to be banned now. And the problem, Bob, is that these are very committed people. They're very angry. They're very angry that they finally got elected democratically, even pseudo-democratically, and they were thrown out in reasonably short order. They had a very short-lived tenure, and now they're gone. And then Bloody Wednesday, official numbers were something like 625 people killed, around 4,000 injured. My guess is you could multiply those numbers at least 4, 5, 6-fold, and some people think it's a lot higher than that. The numbers I saw on Friday's death toll, I saw one number that said 173. Well, people are dying all the time because there are very serious injuries. So whatever the number is, literally people are expiring within hours of when that, or maybe even minutes, when that figure comes out. So it could be up to 200 now, and the violence continues. There were 1,500 people secreting themselves in a mosque because there's an overnight curfew, and they were scared. They thought if they would come out, they'd be shot at, they'd at least be arrested. So they stayed in this mosque, over to 1,500 of them, and I discovered that this mosque is also used, it's in Cairo, it's also used as a makeshift morgue and a makeshift field hospital. So I don't know what's going on in there, but you know people are being treated. There are bodies probably all over the place, and the military Saturday morning went in and rousted them with live fire and tear gas. So I imagine more people died, and we'll have to add them to the death toll. And I don't know what they're doing with these people, but I read that they were dragging them out So first they fired on them and used tear gas, and then they were dragging them out. Dragging them out to do what? Put them in prison? Torture them? There are thousands of political prisoners, I think tens of thousands now, political prisoners in Egypt's prisons. Egypt's military is no friendly operation, and it has absolute firm control, and at least its latest leader, this General Sisi, besides the training he got in Egypt, he was trained in a U.S. war college. I don't think it was the School of the Americas. I think it was another one.
I've heard it said the School of Americas, but I'm not sure exactly if that's true or not. Well, what you're saying is very interesting in this regard. My first thought when you started talking about the Muslim Brotherhood and their continuing push to protest, the successful push to protest, which is looks to me like it's getting beyond even their ability to control, but they don't call it a day of rage just because they want to get out and protest and go home. I mean, they're deeply angry. And my concern is this, and I'll bet Obama's team is thinking about this as well, since you just said, I didn't know that they were thinking about banning the Muslim Brotherhood, but if that happens, then I think Washington's fear will certainly be realized, and that is that the Muslim Brotherhood would weaponize and go underground and form an organized, what Washington would call terrorist resistance to the Egyptian junta. That would be really explosive because that's exactly what the U.S. was doing in Libya and Syria, financing those Islamist forces. So you get a kind of a unity of the Islamist forces in Libya, Syria, and Egypt. The United States having given weapons to those forces in Syria and Libya, and you now have a crescent of U.S. armed resistance to the U.S. appointed governments in those places. At least, hopefully in Washington's case, they want to do that with Syria as well. That is going to, if that plays out this way, and this is just hypothetical, if that plays out this way, and it looks like certainly there are indications that it's going in that direction, you're going to see years-long war. This then becomes a world war in the Mediterranean alone, in the Mediterranean area. And we already know for sure that the CIA has been involved in this, connecting the weapons funneling from Libya over to Syria during the time of the attack on the embassy in Benghazi. We now know that that part of that attack was part of the CIA's weapon funneling program that goes over to Syria. So this is a real messy situation, and if the Muslim Brotherhood feels like they're forced to go underground and hook up with these other armed Muslim insurrections that the United States has supplied, now you got a real inflammatory situation on your hands. Then you move over, I'm just going to do this real briefly and I'll turn it back to you, but then you move over to Japan, where Japan is now making moves to remove their pacifism from their constitution, and the Japanese Prime Minister Abe says, well, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to increase our military budget. Strong leaders would not take pressure from external sources like China or South Korea. And Obama cheering it on and causing some of the foment there in Japan, arm yourself, you know, increase your military aid, all that kind of stuff. Now you've got the same thing going on over in Japan. Now we're back to the World War II scenario, so I'll stop there and turn it back to you.
Well, just a quick comment on Japan, Bob. I know for years Washington, I think it goes back at least to the Bush administration, maybe even before that, but Washington for years has pushed Japan to get more militarized. Can you imagine that? I mean, Japan doesn't have the kind of government it had back in the 1920s and 30s that led up to the war in Asia and World War II. But I mean, Japan does not have a weak military. It's got a pretty substantial military, and of course if they wanted nuclear weapons, they could get them in an eye wink. They've got all the technology. I'm certain they could have an advanced program to develop nuclear weapons fairly quickly. I don't think it's that complicated. But Japan, as far as I know, has no nuclear weapons. But now you've got this guy, Abe, who's an extremist, wanting to militarize. And I mean, this is basically taking aim at China. That's what Washington wants. It wants Japan more allied in Washington's camp against China, already circling China with U.S. military bases. And the so-called missile defense that's all about offense, doing the same thing with Russia, and both China and Russia are furious about this, and they have every reason to be concerned, and it draws them closer together, and it makes the chance of a possible, heaven forbid, a third world war possible. I just can't imagine that happening, but it's possible, and that we don't have the toys that existed in World War II when nuclear weapons came into being at the end of the war. Right now, they're all over the place. Hyman Rickover, I've quoted, the father of the U.S. Nuclear Navy, in testimony to Congress. I did it a couple of times, and I did it just recently, where over 30 years ago, he said that in major conflicts, and I think he was referring to a possible World War scenario, but in major conflicts, maybe when each side is matched up fairly equally, they're going to use every weapon they have in their arsenal to see to it that they have an advantage. So, you know, if you're fighting a pushover country, you don't need nuclear weapons. America uses them anyway, depleted uranium, and evidence that enriched uranium weapons are used in global conflicts in Iraq, I'm sure in Afghanistan, in Libya, and there's evidence to prove it. There's evidence on the ground with enriched uranium samples discovered in the soil, in the air. So America is using them right now. You know, it's not a Nagasaki or a Hiroshima event, but it's basically the same thing, the way America fights its wars. But you get into a confrontation with China or Russia, and all bets are off. Going back to Egypt, I forgot the point I wanted to make, but I remembered it. Going back to Egypt again, Bob, you're absolutely right. Through most of its history, I think the Muslim Brotherhood, to a large extent, was underground. I think I don't know if all of their leaders, but I think most of their leaders are underground now or close to it because they're all targets. The Egyptian junta wants them dead, at least arrested and imprisoned. And if they find these people, they'll either kill them or imprison them. So they're going underground, and they will go underground. And I quoted a couple of their adherents, their members. These people are committed, Bob. They're absolutely committed. They would rather die than live under the situation they have now with the junta running things in Egypt the way it used to be, Mubarakism. It may be worse than Mubarakism. They want no part of this, and they literally would rather die than settle for anything even close to that. And I'll add more to it, but let me let you jump in.
Two things, I think, came to mind just at the end of what you were saying. Number one, just a fact that I want to toss in for us to kind of consider is the last weekend, I think it was just a week ago today, the news came out that Israel is now using drones and firing them on Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. The first strike that Israel did killed five civilians, and so Israel's now already getting involved in the Egyptian situation behind the Egyptian junta as well. So that's something just to keep in mind. But the other thing that struck me as you were talking about the Muslim Brotherhood is I would expect that in the U.S. media, you're going to see another blast of concerted effort to paint Islam as the reason that these people are fighting, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, and you're going to see a lot of attempt to paint Islam as a religion of violence. You already see that even in the so-called liberal media. Even people like Nicholas Kristof talks about that, and the comedian Bill Maher, who's about as religiously bigoted as anybody I've heard. They all already do that, and now you're going to see kind of an uptick of that, that it's really the Muslims that are causing all this violence, and poor Israel has to defend itself because they're not a violent nation, of course not. But then we just have to be ready to respond to that. Look back at the U.S., just in the last 12 years, we have been far, far more violent than any group or Islamic religion has. I mean, Iraq, Afghanistan, I don't have to name off the other six, seven areas that we have been very involved. So all we get is little snippets of some people becoming violent who happen to be Muslims. I think that's going to be a concerted propaganda campaign coming out of the U.S. media. And I think we should be prepared for it to show that that's not true at all. Those are the two things that I had.
Bob, I think Muslims have been demonized. They've been demonized going back a long, long time, but especially post 9/11. But even as a boy, there's a book called Real Bad Arabs, R-E-E-L, Real Bad Arabs, referring to decades of defamatory Hollywood films beating up on Arabs as terrorists, as bad guys, as filthy, as this and that. And I remember a young boy going to Saturday movies in the 1940s, even before I was 10 years old, and seeing movies. I remember some of the titles, but I don't want to mention a title that may not be exactly as bad as some of the stuff that I remember. But Arabs were always the bad guys. They weren't necessarily called terrorists, but they were the guys holding knives in their teeth.
Yeah, right. All he's done with a dark lens or dark lighting. I've seen some of those clips.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of this stuff may show up on TV, on late night movies, but I remember them distinctly. And you know, when you're 8 or 9 years old, what do you know? You don't know anything. You see these movies, and you see these slightly dark-hued people with knives in their teeth going around killing people. So they're the bad guys. You don't have to call them Muslims. You can call them anything you want. But they're the guys in that part of the world, and they're different from us guys in our part of the world.
That's right. That's how they're going to do it. Yeah, the interesting thing about that, I actually had a good response to an article I had last week in Global Research about the idea that the United States government has been using the keeping us safe principle, is what I call it, that the government does everything it does, from NSA spying to drone attacks and everything else, to keep us safe from terrorists. But I've never seen any sustained analysis as to why we need to be kept safe from these quote-unquote terrorists to begin with. So I started going through the empirical studies about what fuels terrorism's fire. And that's what I was talking about in my article last week, that it's quite clear, and the studies are all in agreement about this, that it's the oppression and suppression of a people by a government. Now, it can be a domestic government or a foreign government. But when that government denies them their basic human rights and denies them their right to governance, that leads to terrorism. Now, when you add two other dimensions to it, poverty and economic and political inequality, both economic and political, all of that is the stirring pot for terrorism. So if we want to talk about what terrorism is and why we need to be kept safe from it, we need to start our analysis over here, not over there, because right here in the United States is where the military decisions are made to do those very things that cause terrorism, oppress and suppress another people, invade them, drop bombs on them, you know, drone strike them. All you have to do is go back to the Project for New American Studies, and they'll show you exactly what that means. Those decisions are made here from people who represent us to oppress and suppress other people. That's the cause of terrorism by empirical studies, not somebody who hates our freedom or anything like that. It's not even close to that. So we need to kind of respond to that with understanding that the government is supposed to be for the people, where human rights are respected, there's a cohesive structure to the society, and that keeps us from capitulating to this constant drum of fear. Be afraid of these terrorists. We got to protect you. That doesn't get at the source. The source has to do with the political and military machine that keeps people from having their basic rights politically as well as humans respected. So we need to look to that to end. And that analysis has to begin at home.
Well, there's no question, Bob, and a way I like to put it is terrorists are us. And by us, I don't mean the people, I mean the government. Literally, terrorism is state-sponsored. I've written about so many individual cases of people wrongfully charged for things they never did. They never committed a crime. They never were involved in any way, conspiracy to commit one, nothing whatsoever. The largest Muslim charity in America, a glorious organization, the two principals were sentenced to 65 years in prison by the Bush administration. Other principals got something like 15, 20 years, five of them, and two of them were overseas. They never were caught, as far as I know. But this charity gave marvelous charity to people not only in the Middle East, and I believe in some other countries, but also right here in America, because it was Dallas-based, and the Bush administration went after them to shut them down. This was one of the most egregious examples I know, but I've literally written about dozens of cases, nearly all of them Muslims, nearly all of them innocent people, wrongfully charged, persecuted, prosecuted, convicted, imprisoned, and I've yet to run across a single case of what America calls terrorism. The only terrorism I know is state-sponsored, right across the board, and in nearly all the cases, the FBI is responsible, and if it isn't the FBI, it's the CIA, and if anybody believes that the CIA obeys its charter, that it cannot spy or do anything domestically, it has to operate abroad, think again, because at least CIA came into existence in 1947 under Harry Truman, sad to say, but it's been around since that time. It's been a rogue agency ever since, and at least since the 1960s, and probably earlier, it has operated covertly, domestically, in gross violation of its charter. It does whatever it damn pleases, and nobody does anything. And if you stand up against it the way Kennedy wanted to do, I don't think he did it, but he wanted to do it, and he sure said it. He said, there was a direct quote from him saying, if he had his way, he'd tear the CIA into a million pieces. Well, they got even with him.
Well, they sure did get even with him. And, you know, I think some of that is coming back to us. We see it in our local police departments and the militarization of the United States using the Army and the defense contractors' equipment that they provide the military, which is now coming into our local police departments and surveillance as well, which is all CIA connected too. Actually, this was just at the end of July, Stephen. I don't know if this made big news in Chicago, but I certainly read as much about it as I could. The deployment of the Black Hawk helicopters in Chicago, flying low over the urban areas of Chicago, and the extra presence of troops around the suburban areas of Chicago. There were a lot of people that were really startled by that, and the Pentagon came out in public and said, well, that's what we call military operations on an urban terrain. I love that. They're preparing, ostensibly, to improve their performance in Afghanistan and Iraq, right here in the United States. And I looked this up. There are seven different cities that the military is now operating their equipment on in learning how to oppress these populations. And the cities are Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, Tampa, St. Louis, Minneapolis, and Creeds, Virginia. I don't know what Creeds, Virginia, how that got in there. But those are the cities that the United States is learning, their military is learning, to do two things, I think. Number one, dominate the people in the cities. And two, desensitize them to the domestic employment of the U.S. military. And so you see this kind of trajectory in process. And you know that the CIA is involved in this because whenever there's weapons, the CIA is there. So figure from 9/11 on, we've had legislation after legislation that has created this huge bureaucracy of the NSA and the Homeland Security, unlimited money for these people in the Pentagon. And now the Obama administration tacks on to that, that anybody that he declares an enemy can be thrown into indefinite military detention or even assassinated, even on U.S. soil by drone strikes. Certainly the expanded electronic spying on American citizens, and now the military moving into American cities under NORCOM, the North American Command. This is coming back, and by the time the citizens wake up to this, there's going to be a full apparatus in place to do with citizens exactly what's going on in the Mideast right now, and I think we need to prepare for that. Given the Pentagon has a new booklet that came out called Emergency Authority for the United States, and they basically, I've got a long quote I wrote here, but I won't read the whole quote. Basically what they're saying is that the Pentagon claims the authority to impose martial law on any part of America in which there is a threat of, let's see if I can pick up the actual vocabulary. I've got to remember it. But it's in the event of a threat of large or surprising organizations of people in protest, they have the right by their own claim to declare martial law and disband those people by use of the military here at home. Same thing going on in Iraq, same thing going on in Afghanistan. So here's where we're headed. So let's look at this very carefully.
Bob, I do know about the operation in Chicago, and I believe it was one, I forget the time frame, it might have been 2 or 3 years ago, and, you know, they're getting ready. They're getting ready, they're practicing. Part of what you're saying, desensitizing people. I didn't write about it, and I didn't read about it in detail. I just heard about it and knew what was going on, and it passed through my mind that this has happened before in Chicago. It's happened in other cities. And, I mean, they're literally getting ready for what they want to do abroad and what they may do at home if there's any cause, such as the beginnings of a national uprising against the horrors going on. Bob, the music means we need to take a short break. We'll come right back and we'll pick up on this.
Thank you.
talking with Bob Eberle. Egypt, spying, repression at home, police state laws, permanent wars, Bob. America the beautiful, huh?
It still remains possible to rescue a democracy, at least I certainly hope so. We talked about this at the end of our last time together, that if we didn't have hope for the future, there would be no reason to even bother to talk about this. I think some people are starting to come around. I'm getting a lot less vitriolic argument from Obama supporters about all the things that Obama has done. It just depends upon how strong my rhetoric becomes with them. But I think people are starting to open up and see that there are serious problems that we have encountered. And there was a lot of discussion that I've been in over the summer that started back in, I guess, the end of June, when John Kerry started becoming very public as Secretary of State. And one of the first things he started doing was threatening Bashar al-Assad, president of Syria, by saying he's got to hold to the Geneva One Convention, and if he doesn't, then we'll start arming other people in order to get the country to be free in Syria. And he said that a number of times, and I couldn't figure out what it was about the Geneva One that was so important that Kerry wanted to hold Assad to. So I just looked up the Geneva Conventions and started reading through Geneva One. And one of the things that I discovered was that although I found very little that would really apply to Bashar al-Assad, I saw a lot that would apply to the United States. And so I ended up writing about this in Global Research at the first week of July, that Geneva One says that any neutral power or power from the outside of a state by virtue of its own responsibility has to furnish sufficient assurances that if it causes some type of disruption in another country, it is prepared to undertake them and discharge its responsibility impartially. So the first thing about Geneva 1 in Article 11 says that you can't side with one segment of a population over another if you think that you can control a situation as an external power. And then Article 50 says any grave breaches are illegal, and that means willful killing of innocents, torture, inhumane treatment, biological experiments, or causing great suffering and serious injury to the body and the health of the people. That's exactly what the United States is doing. So as I go through the Geneva Conventions, and I put this in the article, that I find a whole lot more that the United States is not holding up to, and yet it threatens Assad by saying, if you don't hold to Geneva 1, we're going to start arming your rebels, which we were doing anyway, as it turns out now. But this is part of the double standard of having a deepening criminal empire, that it holds itself in a state of exemption from the rule of law, and yet holds everybody else to account for the rule of law. It's kind of like neoliberal economics. Everybody else has to embrace the free market, but when the elites get into trouble, then they got to get bailed out by the government. It's kind of that same double standard. That's a sure sign of a criminal empire, that everybody else has to hold the rule of law. We have a state of exemption because we were attacked on 9/11. That's become the flimsiest of excuses, of course. But there you go. I mean, that's the dictatorship that we're talking about here.
Yeah, we sure are, Bob. I guess U.S. policy is what I call do what we say, not what we do. Because America certainly pays no attention to international law and its own laws and literally does what it does. And you've got the scoundrel media going along as an echo chamber approving of the worst policies, including all the imperial wars. I've yet to see the U.S. media line up against a U.S. planned or ongoing war. I'd like somebody to name one of them for me. And I mean the direct or the indirect ones, even the ones in most modern times. I mean the media, until Walter Cronkite turned against Vietnam, the media stood behind the Vietnam War, and it was only because, I mean, Walt, that was back in the days before the media actually told people a little bit about what was going on, not everything about what was going on, but they had correspondents that were not embedded, or as former Studs Terkel, Chicagoan, who's long gone and we miss him, used to say, in bed with the military,
right.
the governments of the countries that they live in, so they literally report what the powers that be want reported, and it didn't happen back in those days, even though the reporting certainly wasn't as good as it should have been. It's not the way it is on independent websites today, but it's a far cry from the sheer propaganda that you get now. So Saddam's a bad guy, and Ho Chi Minh's a bad guy, and the North Koreans are bad guys, and it's one after another. the Palestinians. What are Palestinians? The Palestinians aren't victims. They're terrorists. I mean, this goes on and on and on. I like to hear the BBC or the New York Times or the Washington Post one time stand up forthrightly on the side of the Palestinians against the worst Israeli crimes that literally go on a daily basis, and take the task, the sham peace talks that are going on. They're beyond farcical. They're literally beyond farcical. There is no possibility in the world that there will be any justice for the Palestinians. They haven't gotten any since the British Mandate period that began after Lord Balfour decided that Jews ought to have a homeland in Palestine. It's like deciding that maybe Illinoisans should take over Indiana because Illinoisans have a right to Indiana, something like that.
Robert Fisk had a really good article on that this week about John Kerry and the duplicity of the United States regarding the Palestinians. So the United States, his basic article is about the United States announces that there's now a new peace process that Obama's undertaken, as you know, with the Palestinians and the Israelis. And then Israel announces it's going to build another 1,200 homes for Jewish citizens and Jewish citizens only on occupied Palestine lands. And so now, and then Kerry turns around in response to that, when there's questions about that, very few questions in the media, but some questions, he tells the Palestinians they're running out of time if they want a state on their own, of their own. Now, how do you deal with that type of duplicity besides laugh at it? I've often wondered, with Hillary Clinton and John Kerry both, how they sleep at night, but now I figure they just go to bed at night laughing as they do this. But he's saying it's okay if Israel steals your land, but you had better get up to the table, Palestinians, and negotiate, or you're not going to have any state at all. So that is, again, not a neutral arbitrator. That's someone who's got a horse in the race, and it's a done deal. Kerry knows, as the UN does and the EU knows, that there's not the slightest chance of a Palestinian state because Israel has already stolen too much of their land. They couldn't possibly have a unified state. As Chomsky says, their state, if you could call it that, is not only lesser in number, but it would look like Swiss cheese with no way to get from hole to hole of the Swiss cheese without going through Israeli blockades and checkpoints. So that goes back to what you were saying, and Fisk really points the strong finger at Kerry and says, how can anybody say that he's going all out for peace when everything is on the side of the Israeli government? That's not peace. But you get the mainstream media that gives it the shade that the Palestinians aren't cooperating. And that's a real problem. So I've been wanting to tell this story for a while. When I was in Washington, D.C., I went to the Holocaust Museum, and one of the wings there in the Holocaust Museum showed how the German government, the Hitler government, told the citizens, if you bring us your old radios, we'll give you a new radio. That new radio happened to be pre-tuned to government stations, so that all they got was the propaganda from the Hitler government. I never knew that before, but there's a whole wing in the museum that shows all these radios. I thought that was really interesting because we have a mainstream media that has done that voluntarily. They have given their old reporting edge over to the government, and they've gotten, in response, closer connection with the government so that they just become mouthpiece of the government. And now, the most alarming thing, you have a judiciary that is saying to reporters, you don't have any First Amendment rights. And that was back in July, Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and the James Risen case. The judge ruled that reporters have no First Amendment protection that would safeguard the confidentiality of their sources in the event of any type of criminal proceeding. So you get Obama doubling down on surveilling everybody, lying about it all the while, going after whistleblowers, scaring everybody from whistleblowing, and then you've got judges who are now ruling that the freedom of the press is no longer a freedom of the press when we say it's not. You don't have anywhere left to go. So what are you going to do? You don't have a media that functions for you except people like you and Progressive Radio Network and Global Research and some other places, but they're pretty small in between. And the investigative reporting that has to be done in order to keep the citizens informed, to keep democracy alive, is getting narrower and narrower and narrower. What do you do? It's getting to the point that you have to have your own network connection just to stay informed.
Well, Bob, I've made the point that you could go back to the 1950s and 1960s and 70s with no internet, with none of the advantages that people have today, and yet there were decades of civil rights protests. You could go back to the 1930s and find pro-labor protests, and of course the 60s and early 70s, the anti-Vietnam War protests, and they continued and they were sustained and they got results. With all the advantages people have today, most people are connected. There is no excuse whatever for people not knowing at least enough about what's going on to realize something is very, very wrong in America. And they should understand that if they don't do something on their own, there's not a snowball's chance in hell that any of this will change. The Republicans are no different from the Democrats. The Democrats are no different from the Republicans. You have to separate the rhetoric from the policy. Look at Obama. I have documented chapter and verse that he exceeds the worst of the Bush administration, and there are two web editors who refuse to post my articles because I'm so hard on Obama, and they refuse to understand or at least admit that what I'm saying is true. They still support a guy they should absolutely forthrightly come out against. As far as the peace talks, Bob, a website I check on a daily basis, it's an independent site. It's an excellent source. It's the International Middle East Media Center, IMEMC. And the lead stories today are with these so-called peace talks going on. Soldiers invade village in Annapolis, kidnap five Palestinians. Netanyahu, quote, Israel will always maintain sovereignty over settlements, new Jewish neighborhoods. And then the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, they publish a weekly update. Every single week, they report on literally dozens of Israeli incursions into Palestinian neighborhoods, communities, making pre-dawn raids, terrorizing innocent people who committed no crimes, arresting them, including young children, some of them as young as 10 or even younger. I wrote about a 5-year-old boy who was arrested and literally terrorized out of his wits to the extent that even a commander was so embarrassed, an Israeli commander, that he chastised the troops that did this. Can you imagine arresting a 5-year-old boy and terrorizing him on spurious charges, whatever they were, even if it was throwing stones and putting a 5-year-old boy in prison under detention, refusing to allow a lawyer to come in, refusing to allow his parents to see him, holding him for days, well, I don't know what they did to him, forcing him to sign a confession? What on earth does a young kid know? In Hebrew, no less, not in Arabic. So you get this kid to do anything you want, and they beat the hell out of these people. They torture them, even young kids. I've written about that. And you read story after story about this again and again. And I'd add one more thing for the so-called illegitimate president of Palestine, Mahmoud Abbas, who I've said on this program he was elected in 2005 because Israel rigged his election. He has no legitimacy. His term expired in January 2009. He refuses to step down. He refuses to call two elections. And in one of the articles I wrote today, I quoted the Palestinian Authority that he heads, saying that they absolutely support the position of the Saudi Arabian government that comes down very unforthrightly on the side of the Egyptian junta and all the violence that they're committing. And the Palestinian Authority basically signed off on that same principle, whereas Hamas absolutely condemns what's going on in Egypt. So does the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the other independent resistance groups fighting Israeli repression. But the illegitimate, unofficial government representing Palestine supports the repression in Egypt and the Saudi Arabian government. And these are the people representing millions of Palestinians, including diaspora ones, in peace talks.
I have to ask, where are the Israeli citizens during all of this? Is the question
dismissive, Bob. Dismissive. For the most part, dismissive. There are good Israeli people, and I think the numbers are growing, who are absolutely fed up with what's going on, and they want no part of it. I think the numbers are fairly good size, but as a percent of the Israeli population, it's small. The Israelis are like the Americans. They get on with their ordinary lives. I mean, just imagine this, Bob. They almost live a stone's throw from the occupied territories. You literally could get in their cars, no matter where they live in Israel, or in the West Bank, or West or East Jerusalem, and go to the occupied territories and see firsthand what's going on. And they're so dismissive, they don't give a damn, they don't care what's happening, they don't care that 20% of the Israeli population are Arab citizens. They're virtually denied rights, they're treated like fifth column threats, and most Israelis either don't know, don't care, or don't give a damn.
I have to wonder, too, if that's the case, taking it back to the domestic situation, because that's where we started. This is an open question, but it's a question that I've had for quite a while. How much is the U.S. government, given that it's a corporate government, given that we live in a fascist state now, a police state, how is it that the government would even pay attention to large protests, short of just doing what they did with the Occupy movement and just sending in the military and destroying them? It used to be the case in the Vietnam War, this is where you started, back in Vietnam, where you had large numbers of people who were protesting the war, and although the police tried to cap it down, they kept growing and getting bigger, and ultimately the government had to do something. But that was a day that the government at least was listening or hearing what the citizens were saying. I'm not sure we live in that situation anymore, where the government actually pays attention to what the citizens are saying, because the citizens aren't informed. That's part of the war on education, by the way, which we can talk about in a minute. But the citizens aren't informed, and they're not thinking critically in large measure, and so they're not protesting. But let's say that changes, and they do. What's to propel the United States government in its current form to listen to the citizens? It's an open question. I don't have an answer to that.
Bob, I want to add one thing so listeners don't misunderstand me. I know some Israeli citizens, and they are wonderful people, and their views are very, very similar to my own. And if they came on this program, they would express them. The problem in Israel isn't so much the Israeli people, other than the dismissiveness that I mentioned. It's kind of a mass illness. It's the same illness there is in America, where most people go along with their daily lives, their family, their work, and so on. And this is important. It certainly is not unimportant. But you need to take an interest in what's going on in your own country and the harm it's doing at home and abroad. And most people don't take the trouble to do that. In the past, more people did, but fewer people do today. It's the same in Israel, but there's a core number of people in Israel, and I believe their numbers are growing, that are wonderful people, Jewish people, who are ashamed to be associated with a government that does the kind of things that Israel does. And it doesn't matter whether it's run by Netanyahu or his predecessors, Ariel Sharon, past Israeli leaders. They're smart enough and they know enough about the history to know these are horrible things. These are horrible crimes that are being committed, and they don't want them committed in their names. And some of them belong to wonderful organizations that I would be proud to be a member of, and I'm proud to call these people friends.
Do you think we can organize that type of unified movement in the United States if they're not even unified in Israel?
Oh, I wish we could do it. There are good organizations in America, and I encourage people to seek them out. You know, I forget the exact names, but Peace Now, and there are lots of them. You could look up peace organizations, anti-war organizations online, and find marvelous ones in America, around the world. Of course, the Occupy movement is still around in America, in all the major cities. I know Chicago is still going. I don't think it's as active as it used to be, but it's still around. There's so much that people can do, and they don't need to devote hours and hours and hours. They just need to devote a little bit of their time. Take a percentage of their time. They allocate a percentage of their time to watch movies, to go shopping, to go to ball games. Why can't they take a portion of that and get active in their own self-interest? Is there anything more important than our own self-interest, our welfare, our futures, our safety? I don't think so. I think that's worth a little bit of time, and time means activism.
I would agree totally with that. The problem that I see, and it's not with your answer, it's with what people who are going to respond to that is that if they're not doing anything wrong, who cares what else is going on? That's usually the response I get frequently from my students when I try to talk to them about privacy issues in the NSA. I frequently get that. Well, they're going to do what they're going to do. It doesn't impact me directly. I don't see any immediate repercussions, so I'll go back to watching the football game. But I think what we're going to see, and this is just a guess, but I think what we're going to see is the logical result of having an empire abroad and a police state at home, and that is when we start using massive amounts of resources to attempt to control the resources that are being used, and the humanitarian costs begin to rise in direct proportion, those two factors of humanity's detriment, for lack of a better word, and the running out of resources that are costing us too much in terms of the devastation that occurs and the economic cost, when those two things cross one another, then you're going to see a critical position where the empire starts to fade and people start to come together to push it. And we're only seeing the very beginnings of that right now with peak oil. The whole reason we're doing fracking and the whole reason we're miles out into the ocean now is because we're running out of oil. And that's the primary reason that empire is being built up, so we can control those type of resources like oil, which rose like 20 million, the demand rose like $20 million barrels a day over the last couple of years, and the water is going to be even worse as climate change kicks in. So if those resources are scarce, and we have to have oil and water to control empire, but it's costing us too much economically and in terms of our humanitarian concerns, including our own self-interest, those things cross over, and then you got a critical point where empire can start eroding. But I don't know that prior to those things happening, which we're starting to see glimpses of now, I don't know that we're going to have an organized movement in the United States or perhaps anywhere else that's going to be able to counter this very strong power that's been built up, particularly since 9/11 in the United States, and that's really what the focus needs to be. And I know that's where your writings are. What is the empire doing today?
Well, Bob, I agree with you. It took decades to get rid of slavery and to get labor rights and to get civil rights. This stuff doesn't happen fast. It takes long-term sustained struggle. Bob, I want to put a plug in for an article that I wrote. It's top featured on my blog site today. It won't be tomorrow because there'll be two more going up. In fact, I think I'll put three up tomorrow. I think I may be able to get three articles done today. But the one I have on my blog site today, I titled, are you ready? World leaders declare America and Israel pariah states, : a fable. I'll just read the opening lines. They're responsible for state-sponsored terrorism. They violate fundamental international law doing so. It's no longer tolerated. Victor Hugo once said, there is one thing stronger than all the armies in the world, and that is an idea whose time has come. And then I say, it's now. It arrived. It's here. And I go on, and my article goes through it and explains things that we could only dream about, Bob. Literally abolishing wars, abolishing police state violence, abolishing lawless spying, abolishing all the things that characterize a police state and imperial powers, and literally neutralizing Israel. I picked Israel and America. I could have added more countries, but those are the two most on my mind. Neutralizing them, demilitarizing them, putting present and past officials in prison, locking them up. And I go through this in my article. So it's a fable, but it's a wonderful one. Maybe someday after we're gone, Bob, something of this will happen. That would be my dream. That would be my wish.
If I was one of your neighbors, I'd be concerned about moving because I might be subject to a drone strike after reading, seeing those articles put up.
But if they hit me with a drone strike, Bob, they're going to take a lot more people down with me.
Yeah, I would think so, living in Chicago, sure.
Well, it's a building I live in. My goodness, it's a rather big building. They would need a very targeted strike with a weapon just strong enough to destroy my apartment, but not take out my neighbors with me.
That would be a chemical weapon, and God knows that we only can use those in Syria and blame somebody else for them. So,
well, I have a window that has got no buildings blocking it, so they literally could target a missile and come right into my bedroom or my living room and literally snuff me out entirely. Maybe there's one heading for me right now.
I hope not. But, since we're on drones, we got to wrap up. I think probably most people know that in the past 2.5 weeks, Obama has hit Yemen with 9 drone strikes. And the total, I think, now runs about 79 drone strikes in the last 10 years that we've made on Yemen. I think we need to point at that real quick with the drone issue. Why Yemen? Why that area? Because that's where counterterrorism, well, they're doing it as a counterterrorism, that's where they call terrorism is beginning to grow. So we've tried to neutralize it in Pakistan and Afghanistan, but it just moved over into other places like Yemen as a counter effort to the United States' attempt to dominate there. So we're doing $600 million a year in aid to Yemen, military aid, just military aid. And there's special forces. Obama administration admitted this week there are special forces on the ground in Yemen trying to root out members of al-Qaeda. And the terror alert that we're all familiar with, where Obama closed all the embassies around and had people move out, all related to that. And now the Obama administration has loosened what they call the rules of engagement for its drone strikes, so that now the lower-level members of people that they say are members of al-Qaeda are now permitted, according to Obama, to be struck by a drone.
Bob, I wish we had more time, but I have to interrupt. Our time is up.
Okay, sorry.
The music didn't alert me. My goodness gracious. Time is up, Bob. Thank you so much. I look forward to getting you back. Join us tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.